picket lines and picket signs. Don't punish me. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. We are talking about race today. We might have what for many of us is an uncomfortable conversation, but I'm hoping that all listeners can walk away with maybe just a tiny bit more understanding. I should note that our guest, Ijeoma Oluo, was with us by phone when her book was released a few months ago. It didn't go as well as we might have hoped, so she is kindly giving us a mulligan. In studio with us today is author Ijeoma Oluo. Welcome to the program.
Happy to be back.
We want to hear about your experience with race, a conversation that you've been in that made you vow you would never talk about this topic again, a stupid thing that you said that you sorely wish that you could take back, the little things that might happen to you, a person of color, that white people don't even realize happens at all. Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. So, Ijeoma, you've been writing and speaking about race in this country for a few years now. You seem to want to actually have these uncomfortable conversations that other people want to avoid. We do a lot of talking at each other in this country. Talk to me about the importance of talking to each other in this country.
I think it's important to remember that there are segments of the population who simply can't avoid these conversations.
Right.
So if you're on the receiving end of racial aggression or microaggressions or just, you know, plain old racism, you can't avoid it. And then there's a segment of the population that gets to kind of decide when they're comfortable talking about it. Mm-hmm. And a lot of what ends up happening is when you have half of the conversation is traumatized, hurt, or angry, or scared, and the other half is avoidant, you know, the conversation doesn't go well. And I think that, you know, I came to this book because we all, I think, know we have to talk about it, whether people desperately don't want to talk about it or whether people desperately do. And everyone is having a horrible time. No one, you know, it's rare that people come out and say, oh, that went really well. And so we're all circling this topic, this issue that's impacting so many lives. And, you know, as someone whose kind of job is to observe the way people are talking about these things, when you see this repetitive pattern of kind of what's being missed, what people are tripping over, and you think, oh, you know, some of this part is simple. Some of it's very hard still, but some of it's simple. And so, you know, I kind of came to this because I was writing the same essay over and over again, trying, you know, explaining these concepts, trying to get people past some of the misinformation that leads to a lot of fear.
Okay, so you're talking about the things that are being missed. You're talking about misinformation. Go into detail about that.
You know, it's interesting because we've been dealing with race for hundreds of years in this country. And I think a lot of people think that means that they should have it all down by now. And there's a lot of ego and fear and kind of shame around not understanding these concepts. So I noticed I was starting to get, as someone who writes on these topics, I would get emails from people, DMs from people on social media, and people would stop me at the grocery store and like whisper, you know, I don't know what cultural appropriation means. And they were so afraid that maybe I was going to put them on blast and be like, look at this rube. They don't know what that means. Mm-hmm. And the truth is that a lot of people, even people who are being impacted, don't have the words to effectively communicate that. And that's because we live in a system that is designed to deny that. You don't come up in school learning how to talk about race and racism. And we're all a product of a system that really wants to act like there isn't a problem. So even though there is one, we're all fumbling. And it can be embarrassing to think that at this point in time, we're still fumbling. But we are.
I remember when Michael Brown was killed, the Ferguson mayor was talking, and he was stunned by the fact that black people in his town were unhappy, even though a lot of their revenue was coming from ticketing and targeting mostly black people. He specifically said, and I will never forget this, I play darts every Wednesday with a mixed group of people, and nobody has ever said to me that this is a problem. And I was thinking, this is not a conversation that you're going to have over a casual game of darts. But I think there's sort of a disconnect between what white people think is dealing with race, which is, you know, hanging out and shooting darts with people, and what black people think is dealing with race, which is perhaps knowing when to say or when not to say that things are a problem.
Yes. And I think that it's hard, if you've never lived the experience, to understand what it's like to be a minority population. And the truth is that if you're a person of color, let's say, you know, you're a black person in America, there's one of you and for every five white people.
Usually, yes.
And even more, depending on where you live. I live in Seattle. There's like one of me for every 100 white people. And you can't go through your day talking about the things that you need to talk about, simply because it will stop you from making friends, from getting a job, from just being able to get on in life. If you're not hearing about what's impacting people of color in your area, even your friends, it's because you've sent a signal that you're not someone they can talk to about it. It impacts every aspect of our life. It's one of the most defining factors of health and the wealth in this country. And there are no pockets of this country that are exempt from that. So if you're thinking, oh, there's no problem here, chances are, the problem is that people haven't felt like they could trust you enough to talk to you about it.
How do white people send a signal that they want to talk about it without being offensive?
I would say, first off, it's looking at your own environment and looking at your own privilege to see what you can do. So please don't rush up to the nearest person of color you know and say, let's have a great conversation about race. You know, they're trying to eat breakfast. They haven't had their coffee yet. They're probably, you know, we don't get to choose how so many of these conversations happen, you know, give people that grace. But I would say, start looking at the things you can be doing right now to look at racial equity in your area. So, you know, look at things like your police accountability. Look at, you know, the school suspension rate for children of color in your schools, and start talking about that. Start talking about actionable things that you can be doing to address issues, and then listen to the feedback you're getting. But you don't actually have to like corner someone. Chances are every area has writers and speakers of color who are talking about what's happening in your area. Seek them out, seek out their work, read up on it, and then find where you can act. And when people see you acting, they're going to start to trust you. It's not going to come right away, but they will start to trust you.
I want to talk about your mom. Your mom, as you describe her in your book and in other interviews, is more than a well-meaning white woman. Your mom raised three black children, and yet she didn't fully understand your view of the world and how race affects your life. Talk to me about your conversations with your mom about this.
I hear this too from everywhere I go. Mixed race people of color, especially mixed race black people, come up to me and have similar stories. Many that honestly didn't end as well as my story with my mom, or my continuing story with my mom, has turned out. But the truth is that you can live with people of color, you can love people of color, and you're still never a day in your life a person of color. And so you see, what you see is surface level, no matter how deep your love is. You don't actually see the every 5-minute hit. And because you're used to seeing yourself, you don't necessarily always recognize, oh, my children aren't being reflected in 90% of the films I take them to. Mm. Oh, you know, that person's staring at my kids weird. You know, oh, you know, my kids don't feel like when they're looking at pop idols growing up, they're not seeing anyone who looks like them. Oh, the teachers that are giving them history lessons aren't mentioning any people of color in these history lessons. These day-to-day things that, of course, escalate in many ways as we get older. And then once we're adults, it's a completely separate world, or something that no matter how close you are to a person of color, you're just never going to feel the full impact of, no matter how much you try. And that's where it's important to kind of proactively have these conversations and really, really listen.
In the future, how do you want these conversations to change, not just with white parents and their children of color, but with black parents and their children of color and in schools?
So I would say, you know, for white parents with children of color, and for anyone basically interacting with people of color who want to have better conversations, know what you want to get out of the conversation first and vocalize that. A lot of conversations around race have half of the conversation wants someone to understand that they are being harmed and that maybe the person they're talking to is contributing to that harm, or that person that they're talking to has the opportunity to help. And then the other half of the conversation wants that person to know they're not racist. And those are two different conversations.
Right.
And when you come out saying, hey, I want to talk to you about this because this is what I need, then you don't actually end up having the same conversation. It always ends in an argument. Everyone ends up upset. So engage with more intention, with vocalized intention, because a lot of times we don't even know why we're having the conversation. We know we have to. We don't know what our emotions are. And I would say for people of color talking in community, first, you know, I think we've been doing this for a very long time. We've been talking to our kids for a very long time. And we will continuously do what we need to do to prepare our kids and keep them safe. I think it's also very important that we always remember to reserve time for the love and the joy that makes us want to protect our families and mm-hmm. our children, and to revel in that. It can be very easy to be focused on the fears that are out there. Those fears are very real. But if we don't refresh and say, hey, you know, I'm talking to you about this because you are wonderful and amazing and beautiful. And let's spend some time looking at, you know, what we've done as a people, what we've done as a culture that's amazing and great that we're trying to protect and build. And I think we have to make time for that in a world that never really wants us to have that.
We are talking to Ijeoma Oluo about race in this country. We are taking your calls, 800-642-1234. David in Milwaukee actually called and said something that I hear from a lot of black people. He's a lawyer, and when he was in law school, some people assumed that he was accepted because of affirmative action, not because he actually earned a right to be in law school. We're going to be back in a moment to talk about those things, those assumptions that white people make that kind of cut at the core of black people and other people of color in this country. It's The Morning Show.
I'm a black man in a white world. I'm a black man in a white world. I'm a black man in a white world. I'm a black man in a white. I'm in love, but I'm still sad. I found peace, but I'm not glad. All my nights and all my days, I've been trying the wrong way. I'm a black man in a white world.
It's The Morning Show. I'm Carrie Kaufman. We're talking about race today with writer and speaker Ijeoma Oluo. We want to hear your experiences of race, even if they're embarrassing or hurtful. It's the only way, our guest says, that we can move forward on this issue. Have you tried to have these uncomfortable conversations with your white or black friends or coworkers? Are you a person of color working or living among or going to school in a sea of white people? What do you experience day to day that you wish the people around you knew? Who do you talk to about this? 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Ijeoma, we live in a very hierarchical society. Our entire economy is based on winners and losers, and race plays a big part of that. Talk to me about how that works.
Race is one of the most defining factors on how well you will be doing financially or even health-wise in this country, including your lifespan, things like that. Right now in America, the average black household has 1/13 the net worth of the average white household. Wow. And the average Hispanic household has 1/11 the net financial worth. These are systemic issues. When we look at, you know, jobs, you know, studies have shown that if you have a black sounding name, you're 4 times less likely to be called for an interview than if you have a white sounding name. You know, that teachers are 4 times more likely to suspend black preschoolers than white preschoolers. Yes.
What do preschoolers do?
They walk around being black, and that's basically it. I mean, and the studies really do boil it down where they put, you know, kids in a room playing similar behavior and said which kids were being aggressive, and it was always the black and brown kids that were picked out, even though they were, you know, engaging in the exact same play mm-hmm. behaviors. These things work its way. These have, you know, if you're suspended in preschool and your record starts there,
and what, you're told that you're a bad kid in preschool.
Exactly. You know, I've met with parents of kindergartners who were removed from kindergarten and told they, you know, didn't belong in this class. How does that start your whole future? And then you get all your way up to college admissions. Then you get into the job market. Every aspect of our lives, there's this barrier that we have to overcome that sometimes we just simply can't. We don't even know it's there until it impacts us. And it really does have real measurable financial impacts on people of color in this country.
The Supreme Court decision in 2015, Shelby County versus Holder was the voting rights decision. What struck me about that is that in his ruling, Chief Justice John Roberts said essentially that racism doesn't exist anymore, that the federal government, that people aren't doing tests to see if people are literacy tests. There aren't these outright people aren't saying the N-word to people as they're coming and voting. So therefore, racism doesn't exist anymore, and we don't really need these protections. It's interesting to me that's the Supreme Court. This is a learned guy who actually thinks that. And Ruth Bader Ginsburg countered with throwing out preclearance, which is the ability for the federal government to oversee it, because it has worked, is like continuing to say we're throwing out our umbrella in a rainstorm because we are not getting wet. So does racism exist? And how is John Roberts not quite understanding this?
Racism absolutely exists. And part of the reason why I wrote this book was from this frustration of the general misconception that racism looks a certain way. The way that racism is portrayed in our media and even in our history books, right, is the angry screaming guy like spitting on a person of color, or, you know, fire hoses and, you know, lynch mobs. And that's what we see, that as only racism.
Right.
But even then, even Dr. King was talking about the financial and social economic impacts of race. He wasn't necessarily talking always about this extreme violence, because what was impacting everyday Black people was also just the inability to keep and hold a job, the inability to be represented in our government. All of these things that still exist today and really do impact our lives. It's actually killing us. And whether or not it's killing us in these violent encounters with police, it's also killing us just in the general stress level. It's killing Black mothers in hospitals. It's killing our babies. It's giving us heart attacks earlier than other people. And people, if you don't realize that because you've been told it only looks a certain way, and people tell me that when I say something's racist, they say, wait, I'm not a KKK member, as if that's the only way to be racist. But what we're talking about, if all I had to worry about was something as identifiable as a KKK member, I would be doing better.
Right.
You know?
I think that racism is sort of permeating society, and that we are racist in ways that we don't even realize, even when we think we're not racist.
Definitely. Racism is a system.
Right.
It's not a feeling. And it can activate our feelings. Like, we can have feelings about people of color that are horrific. But what actually impacts day-to-day lives is how we interact with systems. A system of race was set up with slavery and with the genocide of indigenous people for the financial impact of the most elite of white America. And in order for that to work, they needed the buy-in of the broader white America. And that just meant they had to play their part. So whether you love people of color or not, if you're interacting with a system that was set up for the oppression and degradation and exploitation of people of color, and you're not questioning it and challenging it, you're contributing to that oppression and that exploitation.
Or even aware of it. Mark from Green Bay has called. Mark, welcome to the program.
Hey, good morning.
Talk to me about race. Talk to me about your realizations.
I had an interesting experience come recently for me. I was involved in a men's work organization called the Crucible Project. And in this, background, I'm a 32-year-old white male. I grew up in kind of an upper middle class environment. I've had some Black friends or acquaintances. But in this exercise that I was a part of recently, I met a new man, and he and I were kind of evaluating in a group whose life was worth more, kind of at this heart level. And I had the chance to look at myself, look in my heart, and realize that I inherently felt as a white man that I had a greater value than he did. Even though we're both human, I'm a Democrat, I was proud to vote for Obama twice. But yet here I was having to face this, really this racism that was unwelcome in my own heart. And that's been profound for me as I've moved forward from there. He and I have become friends, and just recognizing that, it's a product of my upbringing. I've found some contributing factors to that, but that there is this seed within me that was wrong and not true about humanity, not the way I wanted to operate, but yet it was there, and then needing to do something about it to see the change in myself that I wanted.
Thank you very much for that, Mark. Do you hear these stories a lot? And this is something that we need to hear more of, yes?
Yes, I'm starting to hear this. And I think that there is a burgeoning area of scholarship around this as well. Robin DiAngelo at the University of Washington, she has a book coming out this month called White Fragility that really examines whiteness, and she coined that term, and really examines the way in which society has built these barriers to stop white Americans, no matter how well-meaning, from really confronting the ways in which they are supporting systems of oppression. And the truth is that we have an entire culture that says that whiteness means more, whether they explicitly say it or not. When you walk through, you know, walk through a shampoo aisle, and watch how it is completely white hair care. And then you have to go search in a different aisle for ethnic hair care products. Mm-hmm. And it's this little tiny end cap of like four products there. That's sending a signal. We have regular hair, and then we have everyone else's hair. And, you know, it's not even an equal size. It's not even like, oh, we're fitting a special need, we're going to have an equal size. It's you have four products hidden in the back corner of this store, right? Every aspect of our society says basically that America is white. And then there's the other. And if you grow up in that, it feels normal.
It's
if
just
you're
the
there.
Soup we swim in.
Exactly. And so then you can feel suddenly threatened when that's challenged in a way that might shock you, because you're like, wait a minute, no, I believe in equality. I believe in fairness. Why am I suddenly feeling upset at the thought of losing a little bit of my preeminence? And that's where you have to really do some deep, painful work. But that's how you become a part of the solution instead of the problem, is by investigating that.
I want to talk about redlining and the effect that has had on the Black community in particular. A recent Rice University in New York, New York University study showed that there are more real estate agents in white and Asian communities in New York State than in Black and Latinx communities, about 7 to 8 times more. There are higher mortgage rates and denials among Black communities. Talk to me about that. Why is that?
So the history of redlining in this country has been catastrophically harmful to communities of color, especially Black and brown communities in this country. And I think a lot of people don't realize that even until like the 70s and the 80s, there were towns that had on their books that Black and brown people couldn't live or rent there, couldn't own property or rent property there. What that does is it concentrates minority populations in certain areas that are then kind of deemed bad. And then you have white flight out of those areas, and the resources are pulled out of those areas. The funding is pulled out. That means the schools in those neighborhoods get less funding, especially if you have neighborhoods that run off of levees. All of these things concentrate poverty in a certain area, concentrate hardships on communities of color. It also means that if you do everything right and you are able to buy a home, you will probably have a higher mortgage rate. You will have a lower return on your investment. So even if your house is just as beautiful as the house in a white neighborhood, you're going to get less from it. But that's if you can even get there. And, you know, we saw the financial impact of the housing crisis. It hit Black and brown communities the most. They were the ones that were given the worst loans and the ones less likely to be able to resell their home or get out from underneath those mortgages. It has a huge impact, because one of the main things that stops white Americans from, you know, collapsing in hard economic times is having property. And even if you get property as a Black and brown American, it is less likely to help you. And so there are no real safety nets for the Black and brown community when it comes to financial well-being or being able to pass on any financial health to future generations.
Right. That is how wealth was created in the late 20th century. The GI Bill allowed white people to buy homes and in neighborhoods that were being built. And then they were able to pass on the equity in their homes to help their kids buy homes and what have you. Because of redlining, because Black people were kind of left out of that, that wealth wasn't even able to be passed on. True, yes.
Yes, and that's why I talk about privilege more as a bank account than a backpack. Mm. It's something that gains interest, and it's something that gains debt. And so when we look at this, it's not just, oh, I came into this world white, and this I have these privileges. It's my grandpa was white and was able to get this, and his father was white and was able to get this.
Right.
And now I have this huge accumulated privilege, whereas people of color are, this was taken from my father because he was black. This was taken from his father and his mother because they were black. And now I have this huge debt on top of the life I live today.
We are talking about race here on The Morning Show. We would like to know your experience of race. Are you a person of color? How do you walk through the world and deal with race coming at you, racial issues coming at you all the time? Are you a white person like Mark, who called us, who had a realization at some point that he was racist, that he had a racist attitudes that he needed to work on? We are taking your calls, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. I want to get to some just like basic microaggressions that I think a lot of white people don't realize that people of color deal with. Walking into a store is one of them. Talk to me about more.
So, you know, a lot of things people don't realize that we go through every day, or they don't realize they're contributing to a larger problem. I talked the other day, I was just commenting on Facebook about how frustrating it is to be walking through the parking lot from the grocery store and hear multiple doors lock as I walk by. You know, my hands are full of groceries. I'm like, what am I going to do? And people don't realize how often it was. And the comments were, oh, that happens to me occasionally. Oh, maybe, you know, I was just locking, maybe they were locking their door and, you know, coincidence. But you can't walk down any street or through any parking lot as a person of color without hearing that like chunking noise as the locks go down. And it was so interesting to hear so many other black people and brown people say, oh, yeah, I know that feeling. And then hear so many white people commenting with, oh, are you sure this is really race? Because they were seeing themselves locking it and they didn't want to realize they were a part of the problem. And, you know, something that happens once, not necessarily a microaggression.
Right.
Something that happens every day, definitely a microaggression. So these little things of people, you know, clutching their purse when you walk next to them, right? Or, you know, people, you know, being like, making comments about your hair, making comments about your appearance in a way that really is, they're trying to reach out, they're uncomfortable, and they're trying to say, hey, I see you.
Right.
But what they're really saying is, I've been focused on the fact that you're a person of color for the last 5 minutes, and I'm going to blurt this thing out without any kind of respect to your own boundaries. You know, we don't normally just comment on other people's appearances.
Or touch other people's hair.
Yes.
It's not cool to go up and touch other people's hair, or even ask them if you can do that.
Or sanitary.
It's not sanitary. So other things that I have thought of, actually, I was skiing, which was about 15 years ago, and I saw a black family there on the ski slopes. And I thought, oh, that's weird. Why is a black family on the ski slopes? And then I'm really glad that skiing is a Zen sport, because I was able to spend the rest of the day going, I can't believe, much like Mark, I can't believe that I thought that. Why would I think that? But that is another way that, you know, if you're doing something that people think of as a quote unquote white sport, like skiing or rock climbing, which requires you to have tools like axes and things like that. You know, there's a black man in the park with an axe, but there are 200 white men in the park and nobody really cares. Playing with a toy gun, which gets people killed. John Crawford was playing with a toy gun in a Walmart. Tamir Rice was playing with a toy gun in a park with nobody else around. Talk to me about that.
It is one of the more heartbreaking things to tell our kids, especially they can't be kids. My son actually my 10-year-old just went to a birthday party last week with a white friend of his, and they gave out squirt guns. And he was playing in this YMCA, having a good time, and the moment we hit the doors, I had to take it out of his hands. Even this little plastic squirt gun, because I can't take that chance.
Mm-hmm.
And the look in his eyes, because we've had to have this conversation before, of just, oh yeah, I don't get this. I don't get to have this.
No.
Was heartbreaking. And these are conversations that I think a lot of white parents of white kids don't get, that we have to have. These are fears that are real because our children are being killed for being kids. That really guts you. You know, when you're a parent and you can't let your kid be a kid and you have to explain to, you know, I first had to explain this to my son at 8, why he couldn't have a toy gun and his friends could, his white family members could. And then to say, yeah, unfortunately, even though it is unlikely to happen, there are some people who will not see you as a kid and they could harm you and they will think that's a real gun. How do you say that to an 8-year-old?
Right. White family members, can they be convinced to not have toy guns because, you know, in solidarity so that he doesn't feel like he's being left out?
Yes. And I think that this is definitely kind of the way that privilege works is you don't know you have it till you're confronted with it.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of what happens is, you know, you don't realize it's a problem for the white family members to have it until you're looking at this brown kid. And then you're like, oh, no, you know, and then you have to reset expectations. And so I definitely say, you know, especially even if you don't have any kids of color in your family, you should be talking to white kids as well. They need to know what their classmates are going through. They need to be concerned as well. And they need to be standing in solidarity. That practice has to start early.
Roman from Milwaukee called. He says he's an educated black man who finds it hard to discuss race in his communities. He says he talks with his children every day to prepare them for the barriers they face in this world. Roman, thank you for that conversation, that call. We are taking your calls, 800-642-1234, to talk about race. Andrew from Beaver Dam, welcome to the program.
Yeah, good morning. I was an educator for over 5 years. I taught in Green Bay Public Schools. I taught in West Bend Public Schools. Last 6 years, left the industry. And something I agree and disagree with your guest is it's not necessarily a black or white issue when kids are taken out of the classroom. It's a culture at the home issue. Whether you're black or white or Hispanic or Hmong, when your family communicates by yelling and interrupting each other, those kids are the ones I see in the classroom getting taken out.
But they're not necessarily, you're not necessarily just seeing people of color with issues yelling at each other, correct? You're seeing that
correct,
all over?
Correct. I've been in classrooms where 90% of my students were African American. And not all of them get taken out of the classroom, not even 1/4, not even 1/4 of them, I have 1/10 of them. And it's, like I said, it just goes back. It's more of a culture at the home, I think. And I want the guest to correct me if I'm wrong, but there's a higher rate of single parents in African-American communities. And I think that's a big struggle when the one parent's working 2 full-time jobs.
Okay, I'm gonna cut you off there. I'm a single parent. My kids are good kids. You're a single parent, Ijomo. Your kids are good kids. I'm gonna stop that myth from going forward. But talk to me about, you know, culture in the home, quote unquote.
Yeah, there's a couple of myths there for that. Because first of all, single parent doesn't necessarily mean that you don't have 2 parents involved in raising
true
kids.
That.
And studies show actually that black fathers are more involved than white fathers on average in the raising of their children. So that myth is racist at its core and needs to be challenged whenever it comes up. We also have a system that does its best to make it impossible for black families to live together. And so we have to recognize that as well. But also, I think we need to say this. When you say it's an issue at the home, and we have children of color, black and brown children being suspended and expelled and arrested at about 4 times the rate of white children, you're saying that black and brown households have 4 times the dysfunction of white households. If you say that, that is a racist thing to say. We love our children. We are raising our children well. We are raising our children with love and care. And when we have studies that literally show identical behaviors with white children and black children and teachers criminalizing the behaviors of black children and not that of white children. And when we show that the rate of suspension and in-school arrest actually is not correlated to the rate of violence, drugs, or truancy on campus, but is simply correlated to the amount of black and brown children in schools. There is no other correlation. We know we have a system with a problem of race. It has nothing to do with how we're raising our kids. It has to do with how teachers are seeing our kids. And when you see a kid acting up and you think there must be a problem in a home, or when you see that you can't communicate with a kid and your assumption is it's because there's no father in the home, you need to investigate your assumptions before you investigate those kids.
We are talking about race this morning during this 8 o'clock hour with Ijoma Oluo. She says that virtually all people of color know it exists. White people don't always know it exists. We are taking your calls. We'll be back in a moment. We are talking with Ijoma Oluo. She has written a book about race in America. She speaks all over the country about race. And we are taking your calls. We want to hear your experiences of race, even if they're embarrassing or hurtful. It's the only way, says Oluo, that we can move forward on this issue. Have you tried to have these uncomfortable conversations with your white or black coworkers or friends? Are you a person of color who is working or living among or going to school with a ton of white people? And what do you experience every day that you wish people around you knew? Who do you talk to about this? 1-800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org, or you could tweet us at mornings at WPR Mornings. Ijoma, you talked a little bit about there are speakers who you can look for, who can come and talk to you about race. Don't go up to people in the grocery store and say, "Hey, you're a black woman. Hey, you're wearing hijab. Why? What does that mean? Can you teach me and my kids?" But I think that there's this whole thing about it's not my job to teach you. Even within communities of color, even within queer communities, it's something that we all talk about. There are some people who say, "Well, yeah, it's, you know, of course that's the question you're going to have. We live in a white society. We live in a straight society. It's my job to teach you." And there are some people who say, "No, this is my life, and you don't get to tell me what I get to talk about." White people who mean well, who want to actually find stuff out, how do they go about finding stuff out without crossing that barrier of "it's not my job to teach you"?
I would say first, it's really important to recognize that when we're talking about issues of race as people of color, we're talking about our lives and our own lived trauma. You know, if you were robbed, like someone's, you know, you were robbed on the street one day, and then everyone who wanted to know what it's like to be robbed walked up to you and said, "Tell me about that time you were robbed," over and over again, you would say, "Hey, maybe you could find somewhere else to find out what it's like to be robbed. I don't want to talk about it all the time," right? And when we talk about issues of race, these are things that continuously happen. There are so many times where we can't choose when we have to talk about it. So then if people come up in the middle of your day when you're maybe having a moment of peace and say, "Hey, educate me on this," it's frustrating. It's also important to recognize that work's been done, that there are people writing and speaking who are paid for that work, paid for that emotional and intellectual labor. That work exists. Yes, exactly. And you can look it up. But even me.
But don't go up to you in a grocery store and say, "Hey, Ijoma, I read your book and it's really great. And can you talk to me about it?" They may say, "Hey, I read your book and it's really great," but then walk on and then call you and book you to come speak to their club or whatever.
Yes, which, by the way, happens to me almost every time I go to the grocery store. You know, the truth is that racism is built on the exploitation of the labor of people of color. And when you're walking up to someone and saying, hey, can you please bear your personal pain to me because I don't feel like Googling this, you're asking for free labor from people of color. You don't end racism that way. And we have to understand that.
I have queer friends who also have different views on this issue. But I will say that you cannot get around people knowing that you're black. Queer people can get around people knowing whether they're straight or not.
Yes. And the truth is, too, the education will come to you no matter what. You're being educated anytime a person of color decides to talk to you about what they're facing. Take that. Be grateful for that. It's amazing the people who want to be educated, but at the same time get very, very angry when you say, hey, did you know that's racist? And they're like, how dare you? But then they want you to walk them through anything when they're comfortable. Mm. You're getting that education. Take it where you get it and then go seek out more on your own.
We are talking about race this morning on The Morning Show, and we are taking your calls. Syed from Brookfield, welcome to the program.
Yes, good morning, and good morning to your guests. My question is, because we know there is a systematic racism in place that we haven't really been able to uprooted for the past 40 years with a lot of kind of like perception or propaganda against, I mean, public propaganda, yeah, this is over, you know, this is just a problem of the black people kind of like helping themselves or changing their ways. My question is there any good information about the prominent black people, both socially, economically, politically, and that are really taking a more serious approach to helping their own community get that boost to get it started economically, to have more resources available, so educational wise, even like, you know, like an athlete going back to the community and helping the kid, kind of like pick it up and get over this challenge that they have to say, yes, even though we have this system working against us or the system that is not favoring us at the minimum, we need to do harder work ourselves and be proud of ourselves. And this is where you can get, you can be successful if you try hard and look at, you know, the challenges that you have.
Okay, Syed, thank you very much for that. I'm going to push back on that a little bit as I'm throwing this to you, Ijeoma. Try harder assumes that we're all starting from the same spot. And there are black leaders in this community, there are black leaders in this country who are working hard, but they need the recognition and help of white leaders in this country too. Am I taking that wrong?
No, you're not. I mean, it's important to realize that there's two different areas of work, right? In our communities, we are working constantly. And in fact, our survival has always required it. The fact that we live in a society with such huge gaps in wealth and prosperity, and yet we are still here with this much violence, with this much degradation over the years, we're still here, is a testament to our community and how much we try to lift each other up. But we have very limited resources, and we have a system working actively against us. If we had the power to lift systemic oppression, we would have. But that's how systemic oppression works. It denies the people that are oppressed that power. It doesn't mean that we don't have a voice. It doesn't mean there's nothing we can do. But we're working very hard. And I think that we can always look in community at what we can do to lift each other up. But we do need resources. And we also just need a lack of harm from white America. We need to be able to do work in our communities without also worrying about police brutality, without also worrying about job discrimination. Sometimes you can do everything right, but if that person that's interviewing you for a job only sees your skin color, it's not going to matter. If that cop that pulls you over sees you reaching for your wallet and thinks it's a gun, that's not going to matter. Mm-hmm. These are things that do not care about how hard you're working. They do not care about your relationship with your community. And that has to be lifted. We have our end covered. We're working very hard on our end. But there's a huge system that we don't have the power in to make a huge amount of change, that other people need to step up.
I want to talk about media as we end this program. A lot of white people in this country have learned about the daily issues that black people face because we have seen videos. We've seen a lot of videos of people getting shot, and we've heard a lot of audio of Philando Castile in particular. But how does media play into this conversation that we're having about race? Does it make it easier or does it make it harder?
I would say that the There has been some democratization of media that has helped. Definitely. I'd say my career is a testament to that.
Right. You're a blogger.
If it weren't for the internet, no one would be paying me to write because I had to build my own audience first. But I would say in some ways it also can really hurt. What we have right now is media that's still owned primarily by white men. And when it comes to mainstream media, they still get to choose what voices are or are not shown. And so even when they're forced to talk about issues of race, it's still going to come from that perspective. A lot of times we need to look at what's not being discussed. And we have to look at where's the power to allow people who are creating real cutting edge media, talking about what's happening. Do they have the money to keep doing it? Do they have the freedom to keep doing it? Do they have the platform to keep doing it? Media could go so much farther. And it needs to. It needs to take it as part of their, you know, journalistic duty is to not just, you know, find the truth according to them, but to make sure that everyone is able to find their truth and everyone is able to speak the truth and that we are getting a broad picture of what's happening in this country. And we really are very far from that.
I want to talk about pop culture media for a minute. Black and Latino actors have been complaining for a couple of decades that I have been covering, I've been a journalist in this field, that when they go to L.A., they get cast as gang members or drug dealers. Is it getting better? What we're seeing from pop culture media now that it's exploded and we can get it everywhere? Or is it getting worse? Or is it pretty much still the same?
I would say it's slightly getting better in pockets. I would definitely say that there have been a lot of, especially black creators, who've managed to break through some very successful media. Unfortunately, what we see often then is that, you know, people are like, let's duplicate that exact thing. We are definitely not seeing this spread elsewhere. So we are not really seeing a correlating increase in Latinx representation, definitely not in indigenous representation, and definitely not in Asian American representation. It is dismal. The average indigenous child can go their whole life right now and never see an indigenous actor as a main actor in a major film.
That is true.
Yep.
And there are more films being made for people of color. There are more TV shows for sure being made for people of color. What needs to happen to move this forward? Because I think we get a lot of our who we're supposed to be from the TV shows and the movies we see.
A lot of that needs to not start and stop with an actor. We don't say, oh, we have a black actor, now we have black representation. What we need are black, brown, Asian, indigenous filmmakers. We need directors and producers, the people who decide what story gets told, not just what color of the person telling the story is.
Before we go in the last 2 minutes, Shannon from DePera, Shannon, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you so much. I just want to say thank you so much for having this conversation. It touches my soul so deeply, and I'm glad I caught you guys on the air today. And my question would be, now I embrace and I love the natural African-American woman hair, and I love an afro. And when I see it just in its natural state and not in braids and not with extensions, I just am like, oh my gosh. Thank you. Your hair looks amazing today, and I love your hair. And you guys have touched on how that. I just want to make sure that I'm just concerned that that might be offensive. I mean, I would would that be taken as a normal compliment?
Would that be taken as a normal compliment if a white woman says, I love your hair?
It really depends. someone actually a friend of mine posted on Twitter the other day saying, oh my God, a white woman just thanked me for wearing the hair that grows out of my head. That's not, no. We don't get thanks for walking as we do. Our hair needs to be recognized. It is beautiful, but it's not beautiful because it's exceptional. It's beautiful the way any other hair is beautiful, and it needs recognition. But we also need privacy, you know. So just, you know, you can say, your hair looks nice today. I like your hair. That's fine. and kind of leave it there.
We have been talking about race with Ijeoma Oluo. She will be speaking and signing her book, So You Want to Talk About Race, at the Madison Central Library tonight at 7 p.m. Ijeoma, thank you for coming in today. I truly appreciate this.
Thanks for having me.
The Morning Show is produced by Colleen Leahy, Brianne Shasso, Chris Molina, Laura Pavin, and Sarah Hopeful. Michael Derringer is our technical director. Keely Boltina is the executive producer. I'm Carrie Kaufman, and this is the Ideas Network.